Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates, episode by episode, the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is Lieutenant Mitch Halleck. Hi, Mitch.
Hey, Lieutenant, you know, I'm one of the only people I've ever been on your show whose name is actually MASH, buddy.
Explain that.
Well, my given name is Mitchell Anthony Halleck, and being the good Catholic boy growing up in the 70s, when it came time for confirmation and you had to pick a saint name, being a huge MASH fan, you know my ego was so big, I said I got to get a saint that has an S so I can have my initials be MASH and have my initials blasted across the entire world every night on syndicated television. So I chose Stephen. So I am Mitchell Anthony Stephen Halleck, and I actually go by MASH because my dad's name was Mitchell Anthony Halleck, and then his dad before him. So there was always confusion around the house when somebody or a male would come for Mitchell Anthony Halleck. So I started legally using the Stephen. So I'm Mitchell Anthony Stephen Halleck, or MASH. So
that is
there you
amazing.
Go.
I appreciate the dedication. So who is Saint Stephen? What was he?
Saint Stephen. Catholic lore, he's the first deacon of the Catholic Church. He's the first martyr of the Catholic Church. He gets, like, wiped out very badly by Romans or something. So, as we all know, in the Church of Perpetual Sorrows and really bad deaths, that's what happens to us early Catholic saints. So, whatever.
Oh, my.
It's
kind of
cool.
Okay. I'm sure somewhere he's happy to know that you chose his name.
Yes,
for that reason.
Yes.
St. Stephen's like, what's a television show? So
I know, right?
We're here to talk about season 4, episode 16, Dear Ma. But yeah. Before we get to that, I mean, of course, Mitch, this is your first time on the show. I have to ask you, how did you become a fan of the show?
Oh, for goodness sakes, I am one of those people that can remember everything. And I remember my two sisters wanting to watch the original movie MASH on Friday night when it premiered on CBS. I think it was at 9 o'clock, and I was born in 66. So I think I was like maybe 5 or 6 or 7, had to be like 72. And my sisters, all they kept talking about was how much Elliot Gould was so cute. He was so hot back then. Now you see him, it's kind of like, well, really? But anyway, back in the 70s, Elliot Gould was the man. And I wanted to watch this MASH show, this movie, because that's all my sisters would talk about. And my dad's like, I don't think it's suitable for a young child to watch.
He was right about that.
I know. But it was, again, this was the edited for TV version on CBS, which I wonder how much they cut out.
Yeah, what was the movie, 58 minutes at that point?
No. And then what happens here, if you grew up in the New York area, we had the 4:30 movie on Channel 7, WABC, and they would show MASH, and they would chop that up too. And all my friends, we all went to Catholic school, and we could make out half the jokes on the TV because it was like a pan and scan version. So our imaginations went wild, and we'd all have these elaborate, like, dirty jokes, what was going on in the movie MASH. So when the TV show started, we were already kind of like tuned into the whole MASH world because of the movie and such. So I remember watching that with my dad when I had to be like 7 or 8 or so when it first aired on the first run. And then I became hooked on it so much so when McLean Stevenson died as Henry Blake. I mean, this house was in mourning. I mean, it was like one of the members of the family died. We were so upset. I remember I was crying as a kid when my dad told me that Henry Blake died. And it's always been part of my life. And then it became syndicated, and it was really popular in the late 70s. It would run on Channel 5 in New York here at like 7 and 11. And then on Channel 8 in New Haven, Connecticut, where I'm from, it was on at 4:30. So you literally could watch 3 or 4 episodes of MASH. And the thing that drove us nuts back then is they were cutting out stuff. Mm-hmm. Depending on what station, you know, because of the syndication stuff. So you would see scenes on the Channel 8 version, and then you'd watch the Channel 5 version that night, and you'd see other scenes. But we didn't know what was going on. And I would tell my friends, I'm like, did you see the part where Klinger did this? And like, no, what are you talking about? I'm like, no, I saw it last night. So you started knowing something was up. And then, dude, I got thrown for a total loop when I started watching Hulu. And I'm watching whole new scenes, not like 30 seconds, like 2 or 3 minute long scenes. And I called my friend Tony. He's another big MASH fanatic. And I'm like, do you have Hulu? He's like, yeah, why? I said, you got to watch it. There's like lost scenes of MASH. He's like, what do you mean? And we're all like, when did this happen? I don't know. Who's this character? And yeah, the last year or so has been an amazing time as a MASH fan for myself, because it's like discovering the show all over again with these new scenes, these like lost deleted scenes or whatever, you know? So
I've said in previous episodes, I'm my mind reels at the idea that they were cut differently for every market.
Yes.
Which means that for every small or medium market in television out there, which is dozens of TV markets, there's that many different versions of any given episode of MASH. Like, are they stored somewhere? I can't imagine they are.
It's just
thrown out at some point. But nevertheless, you had something like 15 to 20 to 25 different editors out there cutting MASH episodes.
Yeah, and it's just crazy. It's like Star Trek's like that too. The original Star Trek series, I didn't realize how much was cut out of it until years later when you'd start to watch it on cable or like, you know, Netflix or something. You're like, wait, what's this scene all about? Who's that guy? And I've always been a huge MASH fan, other than my name being MASH, but watched it all the time, wrote to Alan Alda, got an autograph from him.
Wow. What did you say to Alan Alda?
My mom, because I was such a huge fan, my mom's from that old school where they would actually write letters to people.
Sure.
And she would write letters all the time to like Olivia de Havilland or James Cagney. So we would become like pen pals to these folks. Besides just getting like a publicity still, you'd start getting these handwritten letters from older actors. I guess my mom just knew how to write letters. And I remember she wrote to Alan Alda when I was a kid. And suddenly I get this thing back when Alan Alda's stationary, apologizing for being swamped by so much mail that he can't get to my letter right away. And then he sends me an autograph. I'm like, that's not really an Alan Alda autograph. So then I met him years later at a college thing here at New Haven, and he was speaking, and sure enough, he signs his autograph, and I'm looking, I go, my goodness, it does match the one I got when I was like 10 years old. And it was legit. So, I've been fortunate. I met a lot of the cast. I met Larry Linville. I met Loretta Swit. Yeah,
How did you meet Larry Linville?
Larry Linville, dude. I'm learning to drive in the 80s, and it was like 86. I'm driving down Route 1 here, the Post Road, and there's an old helicopter, like literally a MASH helicopter landing nearby as I'm driving. And I'm like, my God, why is there a helicopter landing in this like field? So I pull over, and it's at a car lot. And it says, meet Frank Burns. I'm like, what's going on here?
Oh, Lord.
And Larry Linville was at the car dealership of all places. And it was like a grand opening. And there he is. I walked right by him. I did a double take. There's Frank Burns sitting on the hood of a Chevy. He was just doing autographs. And I walked up. I said, excuse me, Mr. Linville, why are you here? And he said, well, my friend is he owns this car dealership. And he called me up. And, I said I'd help him out. So it was just one of those surreal moments when you see a helicopter in the background going up and down, giving free helicopter rides, which I don't even know was legal or safe or anything. And there's Larry Linville just sitting there talking to anybody who came up to him. And he and I started talking about when he was on The Night Stalker, which was a Darren McGavin.
Sure, right, yeah.
Not only once. He's on the very first episode of The Night Stalker. It's this pilot where there's a vampire in Las Vegas and McGavin's the intrepid reporter. And the show opens with Larry Linville performing an autopsy, foreshadowing his Frank Burns medical expertise. It's a dead body. And they have the camera, I can only call it like the cadaver cam. It was looking up from the body.
Wow.
At the doctors as they're looking over, and they notice there's no blood in it. And Larry knew everything about the script. I mean, it had to be like 15 years earlier that he filmed this, but he knew the character's name, and he was telling me how the show went, and on and on about The Night Stalker. And then he talked about how he was on the show again years later as another character. But he was one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet, and I meet a lot of them because I produce comic book conventions, so I meet a lot of celebrities I book for the show. But Linville was the most generous. I mean, he was talking to everybody. He was autographing stuff. He was, shaking hands, kissing babies, the whole thing. And, just for a guy who played this weasel character, it was a very refreshing and cool thing to see that Larry Linville was a nice guy. And wasn't
that's
a ferret face.
That's great to hear. What a favor you're calling in for
Larry Linville, right?
To open your car dealership. Like, I would feel I don't know. I feel pretty weird about asking that kind of favor.
I know. I thought I was dreaming. I'm like driving down the road and I'm like, why does it say meet Frank Burns? What is going on here? And there he was, you know?
Wow. That's crazy. What year was that?
This had to be, I was in college in 86. So yeah, it had to be about 1986.
Oh my God. So you're talking more than a decade since he left the show.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
Yeah. No. Hey, look. He seemed happy, and then a couple years later, he did do the college circuit, and he showed up at Southern Connecticut College here in Connecticut, and he did a one-man Q&A thing.
I would have killed to go to something.
Yeah. No. And I got to meet him again because I was the cartoonist for the newspaper, and I went backstage and I said, "Oh, Mr. Linville, I met you." Oh, yes. And he remembered it, and we talked about it, and he did a whole, I think it was 90-minute Q&A where he just answered questions about MASH and acting, and he, you know, met the folks that showed up again. Again, a same nice guy, and had great stories about the whole show and, you know, behind the scenes secrets with Alan Alden, Berghoff, and all that stuff.
But jeez, wow. That's just amazing.
My encounters with Larry Linville. Yeah.
How was Alan Alda? I mean, I'm sure I know the answer to that question, but I'm dying to know. How was Alan?
No, Alda was the best. He was, again, it's amazing. They all came to Southern Connecticut because he did a one man show where he just talked about his career and then he took questions from the audience. And it's so funny. It was just like that episode of MASH where it's Hawkeye when he does the monologue when he gets the concussion and he's with the Korean family.
And we'll be getting to that in a couple of weeks.
I know, but that's what it seemed like because he was on stage for the whole hour and a half just talking about his life and telling stories and singing songs. And my buddy leans over and goes, "This is just like the time he was Hawkeye and he had the concussion." I said, "I know, let's not say that." But I remember asking him because we're famous here in New Haven for our pizza. And I said, Alan.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, Pepe's Pizza, just like his Adam's Ribs. Yeah. And I said, "Did you ever get a chance?" Because I know his dad was a vaudevillian performer, Robert Alda. In New Haven had a lot of theaters back in the day. And he said they had come through town. And I said, "Did you ever try the Pepe's Pizza?" And he's like, "No, what's the big deal?" And the whole audience was like, "What are you talking about? What kind of Italian are you?"
And then the audience turned on Alan Alda.
And then they turned on Alan Alda, no. And I said, "Oh, you got to get the white clam pizza. That's what they're famous for." And he's like, "Oh, I don't know about the shellfish thing." I'm like, no, it's really good. It's really good. So he was nice. Like I said, I've never had a bad encounter with anybody. Berghoff was nice. And Loretta Swit was there, as pleasant as you could imagine. Somebody was on MASH, you know.
Well, that is good to hear.
No horror stories. I'm sorry.
No, that's good. I don't want any horror stories. I wouldn't want one of those.
I've got pictures of Norman Rockwell beating up children. I want that's a MASH joke, but you know that. Well, here's a picture of Edgar Winter slapping a dog. No.
It makes me think of that 30 Rock joke where Chuck Donnie talked about his mother and one time inspiring a monk to throw a battery at her or something.
Yeah, there you go. It's like, you know, and the funny thing is Gary Berghoff is from Connecticut. He's from Bristol, Connecticut, which is up the road here. And my buddy ran a bait and tackle shop. And I don't know if a lot of people know this. He said, but Gary Berghoff made a good chunk of change years later by investing in artificial chum.
That's right. I heard about that. Yes.
And I remember, I was like, and I go, "What did you say?" He's like, "You know, chum, the stuff they throw in the water to attract the fish, the blood and the guts."
That's how they got Bruce the Shark out of the water in Jaws.
Thank you. Yeah. And they said somehow Radar or Gary Berghoff invested in the company and became a big fisherman spokesperson. And I'm like, "Oh, okay. Well, there you go." You know, you never know where life's going to take you. Frank Burns at a car dealership or Radar at a fishing tournament somewhere in Connecticut.
You know? Oh, my God. Wow. All right. Well, you've only got a couple of cast members still around yet to meet, right?
I was thinking about booking Jamie Farr just the other day for my show that comes up in the summer. I'm like, you know,
he's doing the tour right now. So
my wife said, you know, this comic book show that we do every year is not just so you can meet your celebrity friends. I go, yes, it is. That's the only reason. That's the only reason why I have the Land of the Lost cast coming this summer is because I wanted to meet them since I was 8 years old. So
that sounds like you're winning at life there, Mitch. I mean,
yeah, you just don't let people. It's embarrassing. You're supposed to be Joe Professional. And here come these actors. And Billy Dee Williams was here 2 years ago. And the whole time I'm thinking, oh my God, it's Lando Calrissian from Class.
Oh, sure,
And he's just like, what's going on? I'm like, Mr. Williams, I'm the guy that runs the show. I'm the one that flew you in here and paid for your hotel room. Could you sign my action figure? Like, call security. Oh, no, he's in charge. Oh, really? Oh, okay.
So you have a Lando Calrissian signed by Billy Dee Williams?
Oh, my God. Rob, I'm staring at my whole wall here. I've got, like, everybody and their brother that's been to the show.
My goodness.
Autographs and such, yeah.
Oh, my. Okay. All right. Well,
sad.
All right. So we have to get around to Dear Ma at some point. So let's.
Yes, I know. I know.
Let's talk about Dear Ma. It originally aired on December 23rd, 1975, right before Christmas.
Yep.
Written by the Dynamite team of Jim Fritzell and Evan Greenbaum and directed by the aforementioned Alan Alda. So Radar writes a letter home to his mother telling her about the recent goings-on at the 477th. Radar has been helping Hawkeye, giving the camp a monthly foot inspection, which goes smoothly except for Margaret, who of course can't stand Hawkeye's joking around. Meanwhile, BJ buys an expensive watch on the cheap from a former patient, claiming he needed the money for an operation for his wife. Hawkeye has to break the news to BJ that he's been scammed, showing him that there are no works inside the watch. BJ is infuriated, and I operated on that guy's chest. Hawkeye finds the whole thing very funny, having heard of this scam before. Another day, Radar came across a North Korean soldier who wandered into the mess tent to get some food. At first, he doesn't realize that the guy is North Korean, but it dawns on him just as the soldier runs out of the tent with the tray full of food. He bumps into Frank, chasing him, spilling all the food on Frank's shirt. Frank is not amused. Hawkeye, still doing the inspections, tells Frank it's his turn, but Frank is surprisingly hostile and refuses. Hawkeye lets go for the moment. That same night, Colonel Potter gets shot in the butt by a sniper while he and Margaret were delivering supplies to some locals. Hawkeye and BJ remove the shrapnel, with Potter having to pretend he's fine while on the phone with his wife. She called, having a premonition that something bad had happened to her husband. Wounded then arrive, and one of them is the soldier that scammed BJ. Laying on the table, he gulps in fear when BJ promises that he'll have him working as well as that watch he sold me. At the end of the night, Hawkeye and BJ lay in wait for Frank. They grab him, pull his shoes off to reveal painted toenails. Frank is ashamed, and BJ asks if that isn't Margaret's color. Frank fesses up and asks that it not be mentioned in the report. Hawkeye agrees, writing that Frank suffers from some discoloration due to actions involving a hostile manicurist. Radar ends his letter to his mother, telling her how much he misses her. All right, Mitch, let's talk about the deer format, because obviously this is a something MASH would use a lot. This is, I think, the first time I can think where they did two of them in one season. Of course, we just did Dear Peggy not that long ago. So as deer episodes, let's start there. How do you think this ranks among all the other ones that MASH did before this and later on?
No, I know you talk about this a lot when you say when they do these letter home episodes, it's kind of like they had a bunch of little skits that they kind of strung together with this wrapper of, oh, it's just a letter home and you get to see stuff. But I honestly enjoy the letter homes more than most episodes because you get to be inside the character's head. And this time we're inside Radar, who's like my favorite character. So we get to hear him talking to his mother and being this Walter as opposed to, you know, the little nervous clerk around the thing.
Right.
So I like, honestly, I thought they did like three or four letter homes in season four. I mean, Potter wrote home to Mildred at first.
That's true. Sorry. Yeah, they did Dear Mildred. That's right.
Yeah, they did Dear Mildred, and then they did Dear Peg, and then they did this one with Radar. And I think there's even another one maybe this season, maybe. There's a lot of Dear Letters this season, maybe because they're trying to introduce the characters to the audience, so they wanted to have a spotlight where everyone gets to hear from the new characters or so. I don't know.
This is the last one of this season.
They did do three. Yeah, mail call again. I always love when they do the mail and the letters because you really get to hear it. But this one's odd, and I think if you could tell me if I'm wrong here, because normally when they do the Dear Dad, it'll be narrated from beginning to end. This one here with Dear Ma, Radar, there's scenes that happen that Radar could not have known what was going on because he's not in the scene, like when they get Frank's toenails and then the whole thing with the watch and the soldier and all that. It's BJ's story. So when you do talk about how they kind of pick up loose ends from other stories and they kind of string them together, this one, though, felt like that because there's a lot of stuff that's happening when Radar's not in the scene. So I'm like, well, how can he be telling his mother about this if he's not even there, you know? So
I always have to assume that he's hearing about it and then he's writing it, you know, sort of secondhand, like, oh, I heard that. But yeah, you're right. Like, he's not there when when Colonel Potter first gets back with the bullet in his butt.
Yeah.
And he's talking to Margaret. He's not there for that. But yeah, right. Now I learned later on, somebody wrote in, I'm forgetting who it was, but somebody wrote in to tell me that Larry Gelbart apparently did some interview at some point. Larry Gelbart did a lot of interviews.
Yeah.
After he left MASH and continued to talk about the show, saying that it wasn't so much that they had loose ends that they were tying together, that it was, I think it was his wife that said, well, you know, geez, why are there only one or two things happening at the unit at any given point? Aren't there lots of things? And that inspired him to say, okay, well, let's give all the characters, or as many as we can, a little bit to do. And, you know, you have to try and find a cohesive way of writing that, because you can't just do do A, B, C, D, and E plots. But if you do it as a deer format, then, oh, okay, you know, you can put it together. So it opened, I said, after Radar does open – we have the opening of the show where he's writing the letter, and we get into the bit with Hawkeye doing the foot inspection. Now, you know, again, something else I've been going on and on about is that why the doctors get to do certain things that you would think someone else would have to do. Like we talked about Burns is the requisition officer. You're like, Mike, can't somebody else handle that? Now, of course, the doctor would be doing the foot inspection because that's a medical procedure. But monthly?
Yeah.
Monthly? So, that seems like a lot of work.
It's not like they were marching every day and doing 20-mile hikes and stuff. They weren't like infantrymen. They were just doctors and stuff. Well, that is kind of odd thing. You know what I did notice?
About, maybe every year or 6 months? I think every month seems a little much.
Well, the most surprising thing about this episode is when they tell you how many people are assigned to the MASH unit. Because, you know, you think, what is there, like 30 people here? No, Radar says to his mother, oh, there's like 200 people here.
Yep.
And when you look at all the feet. So then I started doing it in my head. I go, you know, this explains that second shift that we always kind of wonder, like the night crew on the Enterprise, right, when they would go to bed. You're like, who's running this shift? This is the midnight to seven shift. Because Hawkeye's checking everyone. 200 people, we only see, like, you know, Radar, Klinger, Igor. There's only, like, what, 20 people that we ever see on the
show? A couple of nurses,
So there's 180 people. We don't know where they are. Maybe they're underground. They have, like, a subterranean level of MASH we don't see. That, you know, because those tents can't hold everybody.
Nope. Klinger has his own tent, for Pete's sake. So
I know. I like that part of it all. And then you want to talk about deleted scenes. It wasn't until Hulu that I got to see their whole bit where Klinger's in his tent and he tells him how he took his baby toe and he put it in a pencil sharpener at the draft board. That scene I never saw when it was on the local TV station. So that was an enlightening episode there, but yeah, I don't know. And we got to learn that Radar mailed away for a guinea pig. Good thing he didn't send away for those smoking monkeys that used to be in the back of the comic books.
Yeah, you know? Right. Yeah, the sea monkeys or whatever.
No,
krill in a jar or something.
They sent real monkeys to some people, which is a whole other story.
That's dear Lord. we start the foot inspection with Colonel Potter, and he gets 100%, and he talks about that he learns about foot care from Harry S. Truman, which, again, another installment of the young Sherman Potter Chronicles, which would be a, you know, that's one of the lesser episodes, but nevertheless, it's a detail from Colonel Potter's thing. And there's something I enjoy, Colonel Potter being, I've been, you know, saying all the season, I like that Colonel Potter, I love that character, and I also like that he's such a contrast from Henry Blake, and that he's not as much of a contemporary. But at the same time, I like it when he can kid around with Hawkeye, and Hawkeye makes the joke about that Potter, you know, basically looks young for his age, and he goes, that must be why Mrs. Potter is smiling in her picture.
Yeah.
Which is a sex joke. Yeah. It's a sex joke.
Yeah.
And Radar knows it's a sex joke. He doesn't exactly understand it, but he knows it's sort of a private joke among two older people. And he kind of just shrugs his shoulders a little of like, okay, it's like when you're a kid.
Yeah.
You've seen something in a movie that you don't fully understand and you're like a little embarrassed. But I like that Potter goes along with it because it's him and Hawkeye understand. No, they're adults. They have a language that Radar doesn't fully understand. Even though Radar's been slaked in previous episodes.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's controversy all over the place.
Yeah. So after that, we have the wounded arrive, and then some of them get shipped out. And that's when BJ talks to Sergeant Callan. And Sergeant Callan is played by an actor named Redmond Gleason. He's got credits in movies like Young Guns 2, Dreamscape. He was on shows like L.A. Law and Seen Elsewhere. And there's this whole bit where he is trying to sell his watch to BJ. And he says, you know, my wife's got an operation, you know, woman stuff. Yeah. And I mean, BJ, I think knows it's a scam, or maybe thinks it's a scam, because he keeps trying to turn the guy down. And of course, it's absurd that selling your watch is going to help get your wife an operation. Like what this, you know, the surgery is what, probably $10,000, and what, you're now $20 closer. I mean, what is that?
Well, we're talking 1950s money. Who knows? It could have been like, you know, $20. We don't know. But still, BJ, he's too nice a guy. And he could tell him, you know, maybe that's the whole thing. You could see the easy mark. And he goes, oh, look at this guy here, fresh out of wherever, Mill Valley. I could play this guy all day. Yeah, I could sell this guy the Brooklyn Bridge and he'd probably buy it. And he does.
And he does. He buys it. And again, he seems like he kind of knows what's going on, but he falls for it. And I love that the minute he mentions it to Hawkeye, Hawkeye's just immediately on the beam there, where he's just like, the patient needed the money to send the money home, right? Like, he immediately gets it. And it's because, I mean, you know, once again, we're underscoring that BJ is new and Hawkeye is not. And Hawkeye, I look, your cat needs a whiskerectomy.
Yeah.
he immediately gets it. And the watch has no works, of course.
Nope.
Why would you even have that? Why would you have the works in it?
Yeah, you're wondering how many of these does this guy carry around in his pocket? I'm like, he's a soldier, yet he suddenly has an inventory of useless watches in his pocket that he can just pull out on a dime. Or lunch pails from, what is it, Minnie Mouse or Mickey
Munchkins. A lunch pail Munchkins.
Munchkins, that's it, that's it.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. And I love the physical comedy. Alan Alda kind of dangles it like he's carrying it, like it's a lunch pail, which is great. And then I love how offended BJ gets, where he's just screaming, and I operated on that guy's chest. He's so mad.
See, but it doesn't work for BJ because he tries to sell it to Roy Goldman as he walks by, and Goldman's not having it.
Yeah. BJ would never go through with it.
No, he would feel bad. No.
So him and Radar, Hawkeye and Radar, go off to inspect Margaret's feet. And there's a great bit of comedy where, of course, Frank Burns is there, and he says, that's going to be kind of tough, right? Your boot's tied to the table. And of course, he doesn't listen. And then he moves in the table, jerks. Mm-hmm. And you know, he literally did do that. And of course, that leads Hawkeye to laugh uncontrollably. And then that leads a little thing about getting the manual. So you just came here to get the manual. You two would have thrown away the book by now, which is, again, another dirty joke on Hawkeye's behalf. So then Hawkeye examines Margaret. And, luckily, unlike in other episodes where Hawkeye is completely unprofessional in terms of flirting with Margaret, at least with Radar there, he's joking around and Margaret doesn't like it, but at least he's trying to keep it less sexually harassing. Because it's like every time I watch one of those scenes, I laugh at it because I'm used to it. But when I watch MASH with someone who's not used to it, they kind of get – they're like, what is he doing?
It's kind of creeping him out now. Yeah, there's a whole different world that's happened in the last 40 or 50 years since a lot of these jokes came about, you know? Yeah. So now it's like, go watch Cheers. That's a real weird show to watch nowadays. Like, wow, Sam Malone should be arrested for that.
Yeah, all the shows we cover here on the Firewater Podcast Network are problematic later
on. Yeah. Well, you know, it's like watching Warner Brother cartoons. But no – and Hawkeye was being serious because I always thought he was joking around. I go, wait, does she really have a weird fungus in between her toes? Is that why he prescribed whatever it was he soaked her feet in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, potassium manganate.
Potassium, that was it. Yeah.
Yeah, whatever that is. So, and then we catch Radar writing a letter in the mess tent. And there's some physical gag about we see somebody sit down next to him. One of those unnamed people that we just talked about takes a sip of the coffee and looks horrified. And Radar, without missing a beat, just slides the sugar over because he says that Colonel Potter insists on making it real strong. You'll put hair on your saddle horn, whatever that is. And then Radar tells the story of running into the North Korean soldier who comes in with a Russian gun to get food. And we see this guy. And the guy, the Korean soldier,
is
Byron Chung, who this is his third of seven MASHes. He kept coming back, playing different roles on the show. He was on other shows like West Wing, Alias, Lost, the New Temperatures Rising show, which I can never fail to mention anytime somebody's on that, just because, again, I love the title. Mm-hmm. I never heard of such a thing, but it is kind of gutsy for a guy who's a sniper to then walk onto the grounds and just try and get some food. I guess he figured because it's a hospital, there's no real security there that's going to catch her.
Well, that's because those other 200 people that were at the show were, you know, sleeping that time. I always thought it was weird. He's wearing, not only that, I'll give you that, you know, no one noticed him, but he's got a different uniform on as well. Like, no one noticed the guy's wearing a brownish colored uniform and everybody else is olive green. That nobody caught that, you know? Well,
I guess with so many people passing through the unit,
maybe
locals and wounded, that people just don't look anymore.
Yeah,
you know, or they're not paying attention. So
they thought he worked for UPS or something. Yeah. Nobody blinked. So they're exactly. Like, hey, maybe he's dropping off a package on
him. Yeah, he's an Amazon delivery driver.
Yeah, exactly. Like
so.
Yeah.
So Colonel Potter and Margaret head out to the locals to deliver. And he says blankets, medical supplies, ketchup for the crickets, for the grasshoppers, which is really disgusting. I love the bit about where they're talking about Frank wants to clean up the unit by painting the rocks. And he says, I do not want to see one painted rock while I'm gone, which is great. Because, of course, as we know, Frank always takes advantage when Colonel Potter's out to do kinds of crazy stuff. And, of course, you don't want painted rocks on the compound because it's easy to spot by bombers or snipers.
Or 5 o'clock Charlie. Yeah.
5 o'clock Charlie. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So they head out. And again, Margaret and Colonel Potter, I mean, it's a shame that we don't get to see them go off together. Because I would have liked to have kind of seen that adventure together, because I think they have a kind of a great great chemistry, as we would see in later episodes. But then they head off, and then Radar gets a call from Mrs. Potter, where she talks about that she's had a premonition about that something's wrong with Colonel Potter. And then Klinger adds that his mother gets premonitions about how she had a premonition about the bombing of Pearl Harbor, but she didn't get it until December 9th.
I thought that was Klinger's.
I'm sorry. I meant to say Klinger.
Yeah. Klinger's, okay. Klinger's, I guess,
So now that joke, I don't think I ever fully got that joke. I mean, I get are they saying that she literally didn't get it until December 9th, therefore rendering it useless, or that she was pretending to get premonitions and they're humoring
her? You know, it wasn't like people had 24-hour news service. Maybe she did think about it, and then by the time she told anybody, it was, you know, after the news Pearl Harbor was attacked.
Maybe.
Or as my friend used to say when I used to point out things like that, that's what it was in the script. Oh, okay. There you go. Because I'm fair enough. How come this happened? Because it was in the script that way. Like, oh, yeah. I forgot. Well, you skipped over the weirder part was when Margaret's leaving and she looks at Radar. She says, you know, people are going through my underwear drawer. And he's like, oh, maybe the rat. She goes, oh, really? They're trying on my undies or something, or my panties? And he's like, well, you know, things are weird. And then I go, well, who was doing that, though? Yeah. Frank?
You know? No. Well, again, one of the 180 people that we haven't seen.
Yeah. That's the Lost MASH episodes. Even that got cut out of syndication somewhere where we get to see what's going on in Margaret's tent when she's away. So.
Some weirdo guy, a good weirdo breaking into her tent. They mentioned in the previous episode that she had a padlock on her front door. But, I mean, it's just there's just canvas. It doesn't take much to break into a tent.
Well, Radar's got that super secret spy scope thing that he pokes through tents that he can see inside when he's like when they go to do the foot inspection.
Yeah,
Frank's inside her tent, and out of nowhere, Radar pulls out this spy scope and puts it into the canvas and sees what's in there. I go, okay, I like Radar. He's one of my favorite characters. But at that point, you're like, well, that's really kind of creepy, Radar. You know? What are you doing with that?
That's a vestige of the old Radar from season one. The more
The one that was selling tickets to the hole in the nurse's shower.
Yeah,
creepy Radar. We don't talk about him much.
Right. So now, then we cut to BJ giving a tour to one of the South Korean officials, and there's a Colonel Kim. Colonel Kim is played by an actor named John Fujioka.
Yep.
He passed away in 2018. He was in movies like American Warrior, Mortal Kombat, the 90s version, Pearl Harbor. Yep. This is his first of three matches. He was also in MASH the movie as well. I wonder if he was cut out in the version you saw on television.
Oh, probably. I remember from Tales of the Gold Monkey. He was a regular on that show.
Oh, he was on that show. Okay.
Yeah, now, he was a samurai. Yeah.
There's a conceit here that is really cheap in that we hear that this South Korean official that is being led around, of course, we learn he doesn't speak English. That's why Colonel Kim is there. He's translating. So he's talking to BJ, and we hear him talk in Korean, and then we cut to Frank, who is asleep, and he wakes up and hears the Korean, and of course assumes that it's another North Korean, in the swamp. Right. Why is Frank sitting outside the mess tent asleep? Why would he be doing
that? And the other weird thing that I caught on Hulu, because of that nice sharp TV trans, you know, we can see all these things now. Frank's reading a manual, like a gun manual or some kind of.
It's his maneuver control.
Yeah, something like that. I'm like, what is that all about? You know, and Frank's just, well, you know, it's, I don't know. It just seems odd, too, that he's just like snoozing outside. Really?
Does he go to the swamp to do that?
No, he's like droop along dog on Ricochet Rabbit. He's like, he's just snoozing outside on the front porch. And hey, there's like some trouble in the mess tent. I better go in there. I'm like, yeah, why would Frank be there? Because I guess Margaret's out of town or she's at a village.
To do. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's got nothing else to do but read field manuals and hang outside the mess tent. Which, yeah, no.
I will say, though, this is Frank at his most brave. Because he formulates this plan and they open the door and he tackles the guy,
which he does.
I mean, it's completely wrongheaded, but it's the most physically brave Frank Burns has pretty much ever been. I mean, and he literally tells BJ, jump that one. They always work in pairs. Frank's doing the wrong thing for the wrong reasons, but it's at least he's willing to, like, for once, put his money where his mouth is and actually put himself in some physical harm somewhere.
This is the same Frank Burns who, when they had the sniper that time, remember, he shot him. Well, he didn't shoot himself in the foot, but he only shot Radar and Hawkeye when Radar was going to get that lettuce sandwich with, what was it, mustard and ketchup or something?
Yeah.
Well, no, Frank shows he's got courage. Remember the time they were on the bus and he's like, pretending to be G.I. Joe. He's radioing in on the walkie-talkie when he thought he had the prisoner there.
Is that courage? Was that courage?
I don't know. He has imaginary courage. When he arrested that little villagers that time when Margaret got engaged and Frank.
He went nuts by that.
You know what? He is unraveling as the seasons go on. So maybe this is one of those brief moments where he thought he'd be a hero. I don't know. You can never tell with Frank Burns, but it was out of character, now that you say that. It wasn't typical Frank, but it was funny, though.
It was very funny. I mean, again, and the guy gets his – Frank gets his comeuppance by – he tries to shake the guy's hand in apology, and he puts some sort of Vulcan death grip thing and twists Frank's hand, and that's the act break. And then after that, we see Hawkeye examining Klinger's mm-hmm. feet for the first time. Yeah. This scene has always gotten syndication. I never saw this until Hulu.
Yeah, that's what I said. I was like, what is this? You know, and that's, I went back and watched every episode of MASH during the whole pandemic lockdown because I was nothing else to do. But once you start finding out there's scenes you never saw before, it's like, whoa, I got to watch this from the beginning. And let me just tell you, this last year has been, it's like a whole new show. I mean, mm-hmm. so I go back and watch again because I've never seen some of these scenes 5,000 times like I've done other ones, you know, so it's a good scene. It's a good scene.
Yeah, it's funny. Again, once again, Klinger has his own tent. We see he's got all of his stuff out. So he's pretty good to be a corpsman over at the MASH 477. Hawkeye then inspects Father Mulcahy, and he asks, where did he get this scar? And he says, oh, my sister bit my toe.
Yeah.
Your sister the nun, now nun, then angry child. And he said he could tell just from the bite, she has quite an overbite. And he says all the other kids teased her. They called her Beaver.
Yeah.
And I love Radar's reaction. It's so genuine. That's mean. I love that. I love the excuse. We told her it's because she was a good swimmer.
Yeah. Is this the season that William Christopher gets meningitis?
Hepatitis?
Is it this season?
Next season.
Oh, because I was wondering why, because he doesn't have a big scene after this thing, and Radar goes, hey, Colonel Potter got, you know, a perfect score or 100 on his foot exam, and Mulcahy just goes, wow, like that, just like a little, that's the best reaction. And you don't see him again. I was watching it going, geez, I wonder if this is when he got sick and he wasn't in a lot of scenes or whatever because he had to leave. I don't know. It's a cute little scene. And do you notice after this, Hawkeye throws the empty bowl of
pan water.
And I always wondered, who did he hit? Because he cringes and he looks back and I'm like, did he hit Frank with it? Or, you know,
I'm betting he hit Frank, because I think anybody else he would feel bad about it.
Yeah, because he doesn't like say he's sorry and he just closes the door real quick, and then Radar peaks and sees, and they both shrug their shoulders and move on.
I bet it was probably Frank. So then later that night, Colonel Potter and Margaret return, and we see that he has been shot. and he's got, we could literally see the blood on his backside. And I love that he compliments Margaret. He says, "You were great back there, very level-headed." And she's like, "Thank you, sir." And he says, "It reminds me of Mrs. Potter. You couldn't ruffle her feathers if you hit her with a brick." And great performance by Harry Morgan, and that the way Harry Morgan kind of bites off his dialogue, it's, you really get the sense that he is like, he's struggling because he's in a lot of pain. And I love that you couldn't ruffle her feathers if you hit her with a brick. Like, he says it like that. It's a great, great read. And his face is all flush, too, which again, it's a great piece. And then I love that Hawkeye and BJ come out. Colonel Potter, you all right? He's like, "No, I'm not all right."
Oh, this tomato sauce I'm sitting in is my own blood or something like that.
Yeah, that's exactly what he said. And Colonel, I love that Radar runs out and he's still got his headphones on.
Yeah.
With the cord, like he just yanked them right out of
I love, he says, somebody said you were dead. I'm like, who would have said that already? I mean, how fast did, where's the rumor control guy? Isn't that Frank Burns' job? Because boy, oh boy, that thing went out fast. I mean, he just showed up. You know?
Yeah, he was only there a second ago. Like, what are you talking about? Like, yeah.
Oh, you know what we forgot to mention? This is one of those unseen things. Do you remember when Colonel Potter left and Radar was saying goodbye to him and Margaret, that they said, "Corporal O'Reilly, your phone is ringing." There's an off-screen voice that tells Radar to go back to answer the phone because Mrs. Potter was on the line.
That's right. That's right.
So there was that guy that we never knew who told people that. So I'm thinking he must be somewhere near the recovery room. He's like a little tiny cubicle off to the side that he could hear Radar's phone. He can't answer Radar's phone, but he knows the phone is ringing somehow, and he tells Radar to go answer the phone. And I was just thinking that too, because she calls again, Mrs. Potter, in a couple seconds, and she wants to know what's going on. And, you know, her guppies, what, the guppy lost the scales, and he's talking to that crazy gypsy woman, he says, or something, fortune teller. I can't remember what he calls her. He says, "Oh no, she's talking to that woman again about premonitions or whatever."
Get yourself a new bicycle too. He says, "Get yourself a new fish," as we tells her about that.
Yeah, how cool is he that he sits there with this local anesthetic and watches them as they operate on his tuchus there, getting the shrapnel out of his butt? And you know, it's kind of weird, but hey, Colonel Potter's tough as nails, man.
Have you ever had an operation? Would you want to see if you're getting an operation?
No, I don't think I'd be that interested that I'd want to watch it, so much so that he's like directing Radar to lift the mirror higher so he can check on his own butt. And I'm like, well, this is weird. And then there is another odd thing I thought is, how come everybody's wearing masks but Colonel Potter? I guess he's immune to his own germs.
Yeah.
Well, because it would cover his face, I suppose, for the camera. But
well, I guess he's used to, I mean, obviously being a surgeon, he's used to seeing this grisly stuff. It's not going to bother him.
Yeah, and they bring the phone in, and she gets to talk to him. It was weird. We're at the officer's club, mother. He keeps calling her mother. My wife walked in, and she's like, "Is he talking to his mother?" I go, "No, that's what he calls his wife." She goes, "Well, that's kind of weird." I go, "Some people do that. I don't know why, but they do."
I feel like that's a vestige of older people that they do that.
Maybe like an old Midwest thing or something like
that. Yeah, you do it if you're in front of the kids, presumably, but when you're one-on-one,
right?
You wouldn't call her that. You would call her Mildred or, you know, whatever, honey or whatever it is
So Sugar Plum, I think he calls her at one point,
something like that. So so there is I specifically wanted to mention this because it's very interesting. There is another nurse who gets a line in this episode, and it's when, because we see Sergeant Callan gets returned.
Yeah.
And he, of course, he's about to be subjected to surgery by BJ, and he's scared. BJ has that line about, "I'll have you working as well as that watch in no time." So the nurse is she's named here in the episode, which is rare. But here it is Lieutenant Fox. Uh-huh. I don't think they actually call her that. I think they must have just named her. But that actress is Lynn Marie Stewart. And if that name sounds familiar to certain people, Lynn Marie Stewart was Miss Yvonne on Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Oh.
And she is Mother Superior in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. So that was her. She was a jobbing actor. She was in movies like American Graffiti and Elvira, Mistress of the Dark.
Yeah.
She was voice of Aunt Harriet on two different Batman animated movies. That's Miss Yvonne. It's amazing how you can sort of be a jobbing actor and then role that pretty much I'm sure anybody would know her from. If anybody knows Lynn Marie Stewart at this point, you'd know her as Miss Yvonne on Pee-wee's Playhouse. But here she is as a nurse on MASH.
Oh, and I like the fact that he goes, Can I have this next? Hawkeye says to Mark, can I have this next dance major? And he goes, calm down. The woman's not a nitwit or something.
Right.
Like
yeah. 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 They're trying to pretend that they're in the O Club.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
To
yeah,
fool
yeah.
Mrs. Potter. Yeah. I love that. Yeah, a woman's not a nitwit. And
I was like, wow. Does she know them that well? And they do drop the line somewhere along there that he's been there for a couple months already. I'm not even going to get into the time travel of the MASH. That's bothered me since I was a kid. Like, how could a 3-year war have 9 different Christmas episodes and 2 or 3 different? We used to argue about this all the time. Like, how long was Henry Blake there? 3 weeks? I don't know.
They bonded very quickly.
Yeah. Trapper was there about a month. I don't know what happened. So, but no, and I guess I'm assuming Colonel Potter didn't go right back to surgery after just getting his shrapnel taken out of his butt. I mean, Frank must have come in.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. And it depends on how bad the wound was. But yeah, you would think Colonel Potter would.
It wasn't until your show started that I started questioning all these things. I would just take it for granted and watch it. And then I'm like, yeah, there are 4 operating tables and what's going on? And why would Colonel Potter send Hawkeye and BJ up to the front on one episode to get Frank Burns when they put the toe tag on him?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking to myself, would you really leave yourself that understaffed if you're the only doctor and you're on the 3 miles from the front? And what if there's an attack and you just sent 75% of your surgical staff away? I mean, wait a minute. What's going on here?
You brought up the guy, the mysterious, sub-radar guy.
That
really is the show's most kind of like meta detail. Is that they acknowledge that there is, by the show, by giving that guy lines, by Radar interacting with him indirectly, they are straight up saying there is someone else in the camp who makes announcements, but over the course of 11 seasons, we've never seen this individual.
And when Radar would yell, choppers, that guy would come over the loudspeaker and say, hey, all medical personnel, there's, incoming wounded. It wasn't Radar.
No. So what is it? Does that guy run into Radar's office, or does he have his own?
I don't know. I was like, I thought he used to sit up near the helicopter pad or something like that. That's why I'm like, maybe there's like a little tent up there with a loudspeaker.
That got cold in the winter. Woo.
Right? The same place where the cook had, the cook was not near the mess tent. And I'm like, well, where's the cook actually? Is he far away?
Does he come in every morning? What's going on?
I don't know. And hey, your fourth wall stuff, you like that because I think when they show Potter – oh, no, I'm thinking of another episode where there was a wall behind him.
You do see the fourth wall in that scene because at one point you see Potter looking in the mirror. And then the wall is behind the mirror. So that's the fourth wall. Yep, you do see it.
Yeah, because mentally I've always tried to figure out the layout of Radar's office and Colonel Potter's with the OR and then the hospital. Because I'm like, wait a second, is it shaped like a Y? Or is it an L shape? Because when the helicopter comes in the beginning, you look down upon it and you're trying to figure out exactly where everything is. I don't know. Those are those minutiae that only the nerds like us get into when we start trying to figure out the floor plan.
Yes.
Of the swamp, and how come there's wooden floors on some of the stuff and the other ones have dirt floors? It's not real.
When you're obsessing about the show doing a podcast about every episode for all of
it. I've been doing a show called The Indie Cast where we talk about Indiana Jones movies for 14 years now, okay? At least you've got 200-something episodes and a movie and a bunch of books. We've got 4 movies and a bad TV show that nobody watched, and we've been doing this stuff for 14 years, okay?
Woo.
Yeah,
oh
still go. Hey, we got an Indiana Jones 5 coming next year, so we finally got something new to talk about.
There you go. That must be very exciting. So.
Yeah, not really, no. Okay, back to the show.
All right, so we then cut to Hawkeye and BJ laying in wait for Burns to give him the foot inspection. And there's a fun little bit of, as Radar is talking, he's doing the voiceover, there's a fun little bit of physical business where BJ is looking at a magazine. I think it's like a Life magazine or something.
Yeah.
And Hawkeye is looking at It's Nudes Monthly because there's a point where BJ gets bored, drops his magazine. Hawkeye's trying to entertain him by showing him obviously a photo, and BJ is just kind of gives like a nah, I don't care. And then Hawkeye moves on, and then BJ takes a second look, like, oh, wait a minute, let me take a look at that girl. And Hawkeye gives him a nice little gag there. It's interesting that his nudie magazine looks like it's entirely in black and white.
They would be, I suppose. It almost looked like Highlights magazine from when I was a kid. I was like, are they reading Highlights? Oh, no, I guess not. They're reading something else. Yeah. And then they jump Frank.
Yeah, there's no Goofus and Gallon in the Hawkeye's nudie magazine.
No.
So they jump Frank.
Oh, my. That was a deep cut for all
thank
those
you. Thank
there.
You.
Highlights.
So they jump Frank and they pull his slippers off.
No, his boots. Those are boots. He's got no socks on. I thought that was
those,
odd,
those
too.
Look like slippers to me.
I thought they were boots. Oh, well, whatever.
I think they're slippers.
Okay.
But anyway, he's got painted toenails. And yep. I look, BJ, is that Major Houlihan's color? He just says it very, very gleefully.
We were talking about trench foot, and we got a little silly.
Yeah, a little silly, yeah. And I love that Hawkeye's, I think you'll find I'm pretty much all business, Frank. And I love that Hawkeye, that BJ hands him the clipboard.
Burns, Frank. Yeah. Slight discoloration of toes. Yeah. Hostile manicurist, I think that's what he wrote down for the diagnosis there.
And just and Frank gets very upset and then just sort of jumps out of his tent. And that's the end of the main part of the episode. And then we get the button where Radar is writing his letter home. And he's got the gerbil or the guinea pig sitting on his clipboard. And he's getting a little snack. And he's talking about the smallest pencil in the camp.
Yes.
Which he does, as we see, because the thing, it looks like you could barely even fit an eraser on the end of it. So tiny.
A nub, yeah.
Yeah, it's really just a nub. And so he basically just says to his mom how much he misses her, and that is the end of the episode. Yeah. It's overall a really sweet show, and it makes total sense that, you know, Radar has been on the show for 4 seasons, but finally get a .. episode.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I did notice it's an Alan Alda-directed episode. Mm-hmm. And here's something I've noticed whenever you see the actors direct shows, and it happens with Harry Morgan too. He does a lot of close-ups of the actors' faces. The Harry Morgan one, if you go, well, I think it's season 10 or something when he directed
it. Yep.
Oh my God, it is like close up city. I mean, of course, you're an actor, you're always going to want to see your face because that's where you do your most emoting and all that. So maybe that's the conceit that when an actor directs another actor, they like to do the very cool close ups. Because on this episode, it says directed by Alan Alda. I noticed there's a close up shot of Radar, there's a close up shot of Harry Morgan and stuff like that. So I do notice that a little bit more than normal episodes where they tend to have a wider shot of the whole crew. It's just me. Maybe Alan Alda's just new at directing. I don't know when he's doing this. He's done one previous to this.
He's done a couple. Yeah. I'll have to look for that because over the course of the 11 seasons, every single actor that's going to be on the show from here on in ends up directing an episode except for Loretta Swit and William Christopher. But Jamie Farr does them. Harry Morgan did a couple. David Ogden Steers does one. Mike Farrell does a couple. So they all get a chance.
Yeah.
To direct. So I'll have to look for that. Yeah, but it makes sense. If you're the actor, you're probably a little more keen to feature your fellow actors.
No, it's one of those things in your mind's eye. You remember all the episodes and all the dialogue. But then when you go back to watch them, if you see that name pop up as a director, just take a note and you'll say, hey, wow, there really is a lot of close-ups, especially the Harry Morgan one. I think that's the one where his son-in-law shows up. And he's cheating.
Strange bedfellows, yeah.
I think that's the one Harry did. And I just noticed watching it again that I'm like, wow, he's like right in their face on this stuff. But yeah, it's it. And then, you know what? Hawkeye's not in this a lot because, again, he was directing the episode. So maybe when the scripts came in, he picked one that didn't have a Hawkeye-centric or he was waiting for that episode that's about to happen in two or three more where he's doing the monologue for the whole show.
Where he's the whole show, yeah.
Yeah. So he said, let me take some lightweight stuff before I have to do all the heavy lifting here.
But. Well, I don't heard that actors, you know, by the way, Harry Morgan would actually direct an episode this very season.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The Novocaine Mutiny, he directed that episode.
Oh, yeah. Which
he's not in very much, which makes sense because he's probably busy directing.
Yeah.
So they gave him less to do. But yeah, you got to figure that if you're trying to concentrate on acting, you maybe are a little busy.
You don't want to worry about your lines and all that.
Yeah, rushing your lines or whatever. So yeah, again, I will have to pay attention to that over the course of the next 7 seasons of.
Oh yeah, you've got time to go.
I got time.
Now you got to go back and watch them all over again. Wait a second here.
I do that anyway. So okay, so for this episode, Mitch, do you have a favorite line or joke?
Oh God, yeah, I've used this a million times. Dear Mom, I'm writing you slow because I know you can't read fast. That. I cracked up laughing as a kid, and I always think about that. Even to this day, I'll write letters to these people, and I go, I'm writing this email slow because I know you can't read fast, just to see what their reaction would be on the other end. Like, what?
What is that? What? Yeah, you glide over it, and then you're like, wait, what? What does that mean?
Yeah, have I think seen? They. I'm pretty sure they ripped that off from an old like Sergeant Bilko.
Okay, it sounds like a Groucho line.
It does. That's what I'm saying. That's a definite old, you know, comedy bit from like vaudeville days or something. I'm like, I know, you know, we like to think it's always original writing, but I'm pretty sure they stole that joke.
Probably. Hey, you know, why not? Steal from the best. My favorite line is, or my favorite joke is when Hawkeye, you know, reveals to BJ that he's gotten scammed. And then he says, I'm going to return to inspect. He tells him, you know, he's going to do the foot inspection. He tells BJ he's going to be ready at 9 o'clock. And like BJ just goes, how will I know? I'm disgusted he is. He doesn't have no idea what kind of time, no idea how to pass time now. Cause the broken watch he just bought 2 seconds ago won't work. Well, BJ.
There's a cringing sight gag that it only means a lot to me. When I started dating my now wife, but then girlfriend, at her house, her brother came home unexpectedly, her older brother. And we had to like, whatever, just get dressed quickly. And I remember having a conversation with my future brother-in-law for about an hour. And then after he walked away, he whispered, he goes, by the way, your shirt's buttoned wrong. And I always think of that when Margaret it does that bit where Hawkeye and Radar leave and she goes to pull her shirt down and she notices that
the buttons are wrong. Yeah.
The buttons are all up by one. She's totally missing the whole time she was talking to them, trying to have a straight face. They're like, wow, her clothes, she didn't put her clothes on right or something like that. And that happened to me. And every time I see that episode, I go, oh, that's not funny when it's you. So
good humble brag there, Mitch.
Yes, no, I know, but it's a cringeworthy thing when I see that episode. So. We don't talk about that, the Christmas gatherings.
I guess not. Well, Mitch, I mean, thank you so much for coming by on MASHcast, reaching out, and doing this show with me. This was a lot of fun.
Oh, let me tell you, I became a fan of yours all last year when the lockdown happened and there was nowhere to go, and I listened to every single MASHcast from the very first, and then I went back, and what did I do? Started watching all the episodes again because now I have all this knowledge that I never had before, thanks to you. And I can go look for all the little details and the guest stars and this happened and the little trivia behind the scenes. So thank you, Rob, for making my obsession even more, I don't know, obsessive. I mean, how much OCD can I have today? But
well, you're Faye, A, that's why I'm here. And B, if the pandemic ended up meaning that I picked up more listeners, then it was all worth it.
There you go. It just takes a national or international crisis to get more leaders or listeners. Why didn't I think of that? You know,
whatever you got to do.
Hey, so, and how can I go by life with the initials MASH and not know everything about the show?
Seriously, so,
here you go,
I appreciate
buddy.
That commitment. Wow,
hey, man,
that is amazing.
I mean, jeez. You know, you can't say it unless you know it. So
that's right. So why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Oh, well, if they go to the world's greatest comic con, that would be Terrific Con. That's me every August here in Connecticut or summer in Connecticut here at the Mohegan Sun. So if you go to terrificcon.com, I'm the guy. I do all the website and all the information. And then we're on Instagram. We're on Twitter. We're on the back of bubblegum wrappers and Bazooka Joe strips. I don't know. And then me, Mitch Halleck, I'm on the IndyCast. Like I told you, for 14 years, I'm serving duty as the world's biggest Indiana Jones fan, and no one's out there. And I have a YouTube show called Mitch and Ed's Excellent Adventure where we talk about old TV shows and movies. And I'm even on the local radio here in Connecticut as the King of the Nerds every Friday morning on the Chaz and AJ show. So I'm all over the place.
Man. My goodness.
My initials are on TV every night around the world when MASH plays. There you go. That's how they can find me. So now you'll never be able to watch that show without thinking of me.
That's true.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
so, of course, everybody, if you want to follow the show, go to our website, frontwaterpodcast.com. All the episodes are there. You can also subscribe to MASHcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Music. We're talking MASH over on Twitter at MASH477Cast. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a favorite show of your choice. So a big salute to Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, Dolph DeVries, Britt Schramm, Mike Thomas, and Michael Porter for their support of MASHcast. I very much appreciate it. So we're going to be back in 2 weeks. So find us then. But until the next episode, that is all. We'll be right back.
no works. It's empty.
See, what you got there is either a pillbox with hands or a lunch pail for munchkins.
I feel like an idiot.
Go with the feeling.